This is a great podcast if you are interested in neurodiversity or designing for sensory and mind. Sonia has done some fantastic research in, and we have a talk about the principles of universal design and the findings of her research and a lot into Studio B and the fantastic things they're doing and how to design for making a difference to people's lives. Let's jump on in. Welcome to the Be Connected podcast, and we've got Sonia today, who is from Studio B, and we'll be talking a little bit about her background and the fantastic work that she's been doing with the Working Brain, which is a particular research into design with neurodiversity and mental health in consideration. So, Sonia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Seton.
So, Sonia, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and your history, a bit about your story, how you got into design in the first place?
I got into design because I felt I was quite selfish in always wanting to do something creative. And by doing so, I selected interior design at university. And I realized that the course was incredibly technical, but it also had its creative outlet, which sort of suited the way I like to work. Then I graduated and started working pretty much straight away, saved money, went overseas, landed in London and in the best design practice I'd ever worked in, which was Amazing. Called Artillery. So that was sort of the start of my career as a very young designer, and I felt like I'd found my people at Artillery. And it was just a really wonderful time in the UK, traveling and working.
I tell you what, that's one of the things that I regret I didn't do, because I can't stand cold weather, hence why I live in Queensland.
Yeah, of course.
But I often having that ability just to fly over. And I think it's one of those great things that designers have the ability to. Like, I mean, I did a commerce and a law degree, so I was like, I can't do a commerce science, fine, but if you wanted to do law, it's actually very difficult to change over, or you have to take a step back. And I think that's the great thing that designers have, this ability to travel the world, to experience different cultures, to work in different places. And I think that's, you know, it's one of those fantastic professions for that in that way.
Yeah, you're right, because the skill set can certainly be universal, which is lovely, but there are sort of particular kind of parts of your kind of training and maybe your existence that do influence the design. And it was interesting to see how, when working in the UK, despite the fact design being universal, it was interesting to see how there were nuances between the locations.
What were those, by the way?
I think that when working in the UK, it was a little bit more conservative than our ability to design spaces was limited by, I think, maybe historical conservatism. I hadn't imagined that. I had thought that moving to London, being, you know, an epicenter of creativity and design, you know, when you look at you know, the big three catwalks for fashion, London's always on the list, Paris, New York. I had this imagined kind of creativity that would reside in London.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic to work there, but it was kind of reassuring actually how far away in Australia we are and how experimental and creative we are. Really? And that might stem from the fact that we don't have that embedded conservatism maybe that was in the UK.
The other thing is that, you know, most of our buildings have only been built in the last 200 years, right? Or constantly been, you know, pulled down and redone again.
Yeah.
Whereas I suppose in, you know, in the UK and in Europe, you're talking about centuries and centuries of buildings and different things going on. So, you know, things are constantly, like, there's probably a lot more refurbishment, particularly interiors, and working to that. Yes. Imagining and from having interviewed people.
Yes.
But I agree with you. It also is probably this is the way we've always done things, a traditional point of view versus sort of a bit of this training culture of let's just give it a go. Let's have a go. We want to do something slightly different. We don't want to be doing it, particularly when it comes to probably our history of things. But I'm surprised as well, because obviously the UK, you know, London itself is as big as Australia and has that many cultures and different melting points. But
I love the multicultural aspect of London.
Yeah.
And I feel that, you know, so I say that I say that and I, you know, want to rebalance my statement. Because of the history, there was a conservatism that I didn't imagine, but there was also this thriving creativity, and I experienced that in the people I worked with. My bosses were three really awesome guys, Carl, Kevin, and David, and they all had their strengths. And, you know, whether it's, you know, winning work or managing the work internally or the creative side. Yeah. And I was particularly inspired by a guy called Carl Taylor, who's got his own design practice now, from a creative standpoint. So whilst I say there was this element of conservatism, there are also these amazing kind of creative opportunities that I probably have not experienced. Well, hopefully we've recreated that with our design practice, but working for others,
yeah,
I don't think I've experienced that. And I've worked in a few places. I've worked in Sydney, I've worked in London, and now I've worked in Melbourne. And certainly that creativity, that warmth, that camaraderie was really special. So I was keen to make sure that when, after having worked for other practices and having moved back as a young designer, because I was only in still my 20s, I wanted to have that same sense of camaraderie and feeling of creativity and family in my own practice.
Mm.
And I think that's what made me leave the sort of corporate world, to be honest, because what was soon apparent to me was that in actual fact, it was hard work being in this corporate setting.
Yeah.
And there were other maybe it was my naivety. It was probably my naivety, but there were other things that needed to be focused on, which sort of seemed to remove that focus on the specialness of the designers,
yeah,
and what they bring.
It's quite funny because when you talk about, you know, we talk about cultures of different organizations and you'd be working in the same designing workspaces, but I often find, you know, creative industry is very interesting, right? And very interesting as people because, you know, you've got to have both this very strong, you put in left brain, right brain, or technical plus big thinking, you know, detail down to the big creative side. I mean, I find designers incredible for that. But it's also really hard because often as organizations become bigger, they become more structured, they become more corporatized.
Yes.
But the creativity seems to, you know, can really be hampered. So it's very, I mean, there is only a few firms that are actually sort of, you know, above 200 people and, you know, how you keep that going, right?
Yeah.
Actually, how you insert that creativity in us. And that probably brings me on to one of the things, because so you came back from the UK, you started a band of artillery, is that correct, in Australia? And then you've actually, you know, you've worked for then Haim Sharlie. I'll get you to go through this, but from my understanding, with Group GSA, Haim Sharlie, and then now Studio B. But it's actually been the same people the entire time. Is that correct?
Yes.
So
yes.
It seems like you have actually created this, but then gone and taken this team or had this team, but in different environments. So that's fascinating in itself because that's actually quite normal in, you know, you'll see it sometimes in accounting firms or law firms, you know, people take their groups and they go. But it's not that common, I think, in architecture.
Interesting.
I haven't seen somebody taken that many, like taken, you know, people normally hop around a little bit more. So let's just sort of talk about that. Obviously, you found this really special sort of part, which was creative, finding how we create, but you're a very genuine, you know, thoughtful person as well. Tell us a little bit about the team and, you know, that journey as you've gone through as well.
So I was about to turn 40 and artillery had been going for over a decade at that point in time. And artillery, by the way, the name stems from Artillery Lane in London. So there's a reason for the name. Anyway, so it had been going for over a decade and it was possibly time for a new decade, I felt, in my life. I had a couple of young kids. I was ready to possibly take a foray into a larger practice. The reason being is because being a smaller design practice, we were often described as a boutique practice. And this was in the heyday of design pre the GFC.
Yeah.
And we really struggled to be able to, even though our team was incredibly senior, we struggled to be considered seriously for the large projects because we weren't a practice of 100 plus more people.
Yeah.
By way of example, or even 50 plus people. So it made sense to us to try to, because we had an established brand in Melbourne, to try to be a part of this larger practice and see what sort of opportunities that would enable us to do to have. So we did merge with Group GSA, who approached us. We didn't approach them. In fact, it was furthest from my dreams, to be honest. And out of the blue, a couple of design practices popped up and asked us to merge with them. And in both instances, we said no. But I think it had, perhaps we had come close on a few projects, but we couldn't get them over the line for the fact that the larger practices won. And it got us a thinking, well, maybe this isn't a bad kind of move then. We've still the same team, but perhaps we'll be taken more seriously on the larger projects. So that's what, after Group GSA and the owner at the time, Mark Sheldon, you know, stayed in touch for, I think it was maybe 18 months, I can't remember. We finally agreed that it wasn't a bad thing. And as a collective, that, you know, all the members of Artillery felt that this would be worth a go. And so it ended up working out really well at Group GSA. We had a great rapport with the team there, and it was Mark Sheldon who was a great advocate of ours. Then we also had a couple of other people who were awesome, Peter McCamley and Pablo Albani, and they were all based in Sydney. And we had a great rapport with them.
Mm.
And we were there for 4 years, and then Mark Sheldon decided to retire. And so once again, it went down a positive path, but a different path. And for us, there was an opportunity to then continue moving and hunting for this, you know, special kind of existence that we had. And we then moved to Home Charlie, which was also positive. But what we were missing was that special, so we were now a part of this larger team, but we were missing this special environment that we had created. And by now we think the world's ready to accept the smaller practices. Do you know what I mean? It's no longer you have to be big, because
I think
the world's matured.
Yeah. I think the world's going to change again too.
I reckon. And sometimes,
I think that. It's funny, obviously, working with architecture firms. Most firms are actually not big.
Yes.
That's the thing. Like, there's about 7,000 architecture and design firms, right? And there is only probably 50 who are over a certain size. I obviously have all of this analysis, and we're doing it. We're actually doing that for a client at the moment. And the thing is, though, majority of firms are small, and it's because, you know, you can produce the same outputs, but you don't need to, because even in that size, if you're working on a project, you're not going to have anybody who's really more than sort of 8 to 10 people on a project, unless it gets, you know, unless it's a massive architectural project, for interiors project.
Yes.
It's going to always flex and be like that. I think what will be interesting in the next 10 to 20 years is honestly with the emergence of AI and things like that, everybody's always going, oh, how big's your team? What do you think? How many people? And it's like, what does that have to do with the smell of an oily rag? Because at the end of the day, it's actually going to be the output that you provide.
Absolutely.
The team, I think that this is where we're going to be entering in the next 10 years, a time where small firms actually have a very competitive edge, or will actually, the boutique will become, and I think it has become more and more, because the overheads and the risks and things like that. But it also gets bigger. You turn into a bigger machine. All of those elements happen, but at the same time, it depends what you're trying to achieve, right? So for some people, they want to grow it. They need to get the next generation through. Some people, you know, the engineers, they like to grow, find somebody to buy them out. It's a different driver. It can be really, I think, by the founders or the leaders of the business making that direction, because there's the creativity side, but then there is obviously the business side as well. So it's interesting, though, how firms keep this, the creativity or the essence of what makes them special or the unique value proposition. And that's what I think is very unique about you guys and Studio B, because I think when you, and we're going to talk about this with the Working Brain, but also your approach. So let's talk about this special thing that you guys have always had culturally and your approach of what you did. And now, you know, what Studio B Now you're in your own entity again. And what this sort of this unique approach is versus other firms?
I think there's an inherent curiosity in us and really all designers that I mentioned when I first left uni, or when I was about to start uni, I wanted to do something creative, which I felt was a little bit self-serving, a little bit selfish, as opposed to rather than choosing a profession, you know, like in health or nursing or being a doctor or some way helping people.
And most designers, when I ask them why do they want to do it, they did want to help people. And that's quite interesting. It's quite funny because you think about design, I suppose, from a, most people think about it in a, you know, you could think about it in a, you've said selfish or design point of view, yeah. But actually design is about making a difference to people's lives. I'm sitting in a room now that doesn't have great light for a podcast, but
geez,
my happiness is much better in the house I'm in now versus the house that I was. And I actually didn't realize how much it affects space, you know, knowing in the theory that space has a massive effect on us.
Huge in our effect, daily lives. Yeah.
And one of our podcasts, you know, we were talking to somebody and he said that we spend 90% of our lives indoors.
Yes.
So you're actually designing for the impact of what we're actually spending, you know, particularly in workspaces. The space can actually have an impact on both, you know, for somebody who's neurodiverse like me and your concentration levels, but also in actually how you enable people to move around a space and interact and things like that.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about that, about, you know, the types of spaces that you, whilst you felt like it might have been a bit selfish doing it, your driver has always been to obviously help people.
Yeah. And I think that was the lack of maturity at my end where I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I can do something I love. And then searching for how can we turn that into helping people. But it took a while to figure it out. Yes, you know, we're designing workplaces where people spend most of their time. It was important they were designed well because of that sort of circle of, you know, quality of life, being happy, doing a better job when you're happy, being comfortable in space. All of that made sense and that was great. But what was interesting was that we still wanted to kind of measure things a little bit more and understand things a little bit more. And that's when we stumbled onto designing for the neurodiverse cohort, but not only that. And I'll tell you about some of our other sort of areas of interest as well.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to see if there was any research really in designing for neurodiversity. And we established quickly that there wasn't anything that we could reference per se or use at the time, and I'm talking about 6 years ago now. So we started our own research project and we called it the Working Brain, and we established what the neurodiversities were and then looked at what was kind of a common theme amongst the neurodiversities, and that's the sensory processing differences that led on to sensory comfort. We found an occupational therapist who's a leader in her or in this field, and she's based in the States, and she authored a particular tool, a diagnostic tool for sensory profiling. And so we started sensory profiling people to understand what our senses are made up from, and we'd made the assumption that we'd all have a sensory profile that was that 20% of us would have a sensory profile that was one or more deviations above the standard. And we found that in actual fact, 60% of us have
a
sensory profile that's one or more standard deviations above the standard bell curve. And this was all through learning about this with Winnie Dunn, who is this extraordinary human being who has been our mentor and spirit guide and just generally, what's a really good word? She's an enabler of everything. So we found her, and we found another guy called Andrew Eddy, who is an autism advocate, and he helped autism people. He's retired now, but he helped autistic people get work following university, because from him we learned that autistic people are overrepresented in unemployment figures. So it made sense to us.
Yeah.
How could we create better workplaces to attract autistic people to be inclusive and then therefore to impact positively on society? And, you know, knowing that design's only one part of the puzzle, but by doing that, we started hunting for what it is that we needed to do. And then we did this study, and it was through autistic children that she found that our environment has a big impact on our senses. So it's the autistic people who've showed us the way, in that we've discovered that actually many of us have this positive or negative sensory impact because of events that are happening around us, you know, sensory events. And if we improve our environment, we can then be more inclusive. And as she says, universal design is good for us all. And that's all it comes down to, is universal design.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I mean, if anybody doesn't understand what universal design is listening, essentially it's, you know, if you look at a bell curve, right, and if you think about those sort of 10% at the ends of the bell curve, if you design for those people in mind, everybody else prospers. And that's obviously how you and I connected, was by running a neurodiversity event, and I was looking for designers the same way. I had nothing of it going on. I was neurodiverse. I'd hidden that for years and never mentioned it. And you know, in starting my own business and mainly being in my own office with a closed space, oh my God, my productivity is through the roof. And I'm not burnt out all the time. Mind you, as an HR person, you're also giving all the time. So HR burnout's a thing in itself too. But it's probably from a personal story, I can tell the difference, right? Mm. But can you tell me a little bit more about what you've sort of seen? And you've actually designed Haim Charlie office in Melbourne with that in mind. So tell us a little bit about some of the principles that you've learned for, you know, with universal design in mind, that we are actually designing better workplaces for people to thrive.
So one of the key principles of universal design, and there are seven, is flexibility in use is one of the seven. And we found that that was very important when it came to sensory design, enabling people to empower themselves and choose spaces based on their sensory comfort. So we call it sensory-based working. We've coined that term instead of activity-based working because you can choose a setting based on your sensory needs. So therefore, you can choose a quiet space if you need one, a space with dull light. Potentially, you can dim the light, an area where you can remove distractions from around you so that you're not facing a view, but you're facing quite a low stimulation kind of wall with acoustic panels. Or you might need to be the best version of yourself because you need to be stimulated. So you need to choose an active space, a noisy space, an open plan space with other people, with music and noise and energy and activity. So that flexibility in use is a very important ingredient in what we discovered. The other thing is multimodal design, having spaces that offer different settings. And I described those settings just before. So having many different modes, high intensity zones, low intensity zones, transitional zones to move between the spaces. Sometimes we call those, I would call those recalibration zones. That's another important factor. And then the third thing is to have sensory design inclusions. So they might be things that encourage your body to do things such as to balance on a wiggly chair or to climb or hang or stretch or do heavy work or have wide corridors or something that encourages you to do things a little bit differently that helps you focus or helps you recalibrate. And that came through the students and the children that Winnie Dunn and other occupational therapists work with. That sort of knowledge came from that. So that's the third ingredient. But we discovered that 60%, as I mentioned before, of us have a heightened sensory response. And about half of that 60% have low neurological thresholds, so highly sensitive. And about a third of that 60% in our research have high neurological thresholds, so are undersensitive or hyposensitive, and they need the stimulation. So if there was a formula for designing space that I could recommend to all designers, that would be to design the space with about half low stimulation, about a third intense high stimulation, and then the leftover space as the in-between space, whatever you need. And by enabling the flexibility, you know you're going to hit all the groups pretty well. And then all of a sudden, hopefully, we've made it more comfortable for more people. And that's basically the whole summary of the research of the 5 years.
Amazing. And I think the thing is, though, you know, everybody puts it into neurodiversity. I actually think it's just about understanding. That's why I like it, the working brain. Because at the end of the day, you know, I think when people talk to me about, oh, how do we support people? It's like, it's an individualistic thing. And I think we have to all learn about ourselves, right? You know, I've got two small children. I'm sort of learning that as they go on their journey versus coming from a time when you didn't sort of weren't so self-aware of things. I think we're living in a time now that we have to be self-aware of where our energy is and what's happening to our brains, because we can get so frazzled so easily. So whether it's in the workspace or whether it's in the habits that we do on a daily basis, I mean, at the end of the day, we talked about we're spending 90% of our lives inside, right? Let's say that's a throwaway comment, but probably a little bit too close to the mark. But our brains for millions of years were designed to be in nature. We're designed to wake up when the sun wakes up, not wake up by alarm clock or blue light on our phones. Wasn't designed to sit at a desk all day and to look at things. Wasn't designed to have social media with dopamine hits hitting us. Designed to have sugar all the time and all these things. So we now live in a world that our, you know, we're very lucky. We have everything around us, shelter, water, everything we need on Maslow's hierarchy, base hierarchy of needs. But in some ways, we've got to this point that we have so much stimuli that we being able to learn how to control it. So even you talking then, it's quite funny. I've moved into a space, right? The old space is quite small and dark, but it's interesting now. I do have a beautiful view and all these things, but it's interesting because I'm all about peak performance and getting to flow state and everything like that. I can probably appreciate maybe there is things around me in that space that is actually having a sensory. And the same thing, you know, I'll try and look at where my energy is within the day, what am I doing, salt lamps, different things, right, to try and get to that peak output, you know, all the time, which, you know, as Meg Price said, we're not here as machines. We are here to interact and do all that. You know, performance isn't the thing that we all should be going for. But in essence, I think it's very important for us as individuals to know ourselves as much as it is to have the space to be able to do that in. And that's what you're saying, is to create the space is one element. And to do that, I think the next part is how we can also enable that for people to thrive in their workplaces by their practices and their policies and other things that enable. But I think we're going to enter, and I'd be interested what you think too, because your children are a little bit older than mine. I think with the next generation coming out, I think there's a lot more knowledge of themselves, or there's a lot more focus on our children knowing how they're feeling or identifying or doing that. Now, that's a flip side. What are you seeing in schools and how that's emerging, and what are you thinking this is going to look like for the next 10 years and the Gen Zs, and you know, we can go into all that data. But do you think we're also at a, do you observe that we're also potentially at a changing point? These things are just going to become more and more important.
I think so. And I think that we contribute to that awareness and education through our research as a step in, you know, a different part of the world, you know, where we have researchers who are in the medical field, by way of example, who are doing this research. Sometimes it doesn't always filter down to us in a sort of less medical world, not explaining that very well, but we're helping with the awareness just through
practical
our research.
Okay.
And also I think there's a general feeling in the air that everyone's more, you know, whilst it was quite, secretive, you know, maybe even five or more years ago when people were being secretive about diagnoses and they weren't comfortable enough to declare this, we're certainly seeing, you know, a big move in the other direction, which is positive. And that applies to all sorts of things, not only neurodiversity, but, you know, a broader communities more broadly accepting of identity. Yeah. And whilst it's not perfect, I think it's a better place to live now than it, say, would have been a decade ago or more for for lots of things. So where it is in schools, I think that schools are great and progressive in their viewpoints. I don't think the design is great though, because in many schools, not all schools, of course.
Yeah.
Because I do think that there's always a lag, isn't there, behind things.
And yeah.
There are principles in place, and sometimes I heard and I thought she summarized it really well, something that Mary Featherstone was saying on a podcast, in that, you know, we've got this great sort of vision of creating spaces in a particular way, which is where a lot of the templates ended up being in the public schools. But the problem is with those is that the pedagogy doesn't follow that template. So the pedagogy is caught in an older sort of in a more, you know, aged kind of format. And so the spaces are not really working, right? And in actual fact, the open plan spaces are very disruptive for the children, because the pedagogy doesn't follow the principles of what those spaces were designed for. And that movement and the ability for kids, you know, quite often these quiet spaces are used as storerooms. I have physically seen this in the schools that my children have attended, rather than as spaces for children to be able to get additional support or do focus work. So that's a problem, but hopefully we'll catch up, right?
Look, and I mean, I think it's fascinating, because obviously I've just started looking at primary schools. My little one started to go, and you know, I've got amazing public schools near me, right?
Yes.
And we've also got this great Catholic school. We were like, yep, let's go. And I looked at the space and I'm like, my son is not going to be able to move here. He has to move. We literally chose the school. Like, we need zones. We need these types of things. And my partner works in a company where they design for playscapes and risk and design and risk and play and movement, all these things, right? So we're quite eccentric. So we're quite aware of all this stuff. We're sort of looking and go, shit, actually most of these things aren't there. Like, our kids go to childcare with nothing that we would be designed or be up to date with. Mind you, though, we take them fishing every night down to the lake. We get them out, you know, we do that in our personal lives. But I think it will be interesting how that progresses as children grow into adults and now entering the workforce. I think we're going to be entering a different way that work is done as well. I mean, we're already seeing these shifts happening. Right, where we are now. But obviously your research is fascinating. And I think that's one of the things, Sonia, I obviously work with and know a lot of different designers. It sounds like a lot of, you know, what you do is always embedded in what is the research behind. So let's talk a little bit about that with Studio B. So we've just talked about with the working brain, but very much that coming back to that core part of this group that has continued throughout. So whilst under different names, essentially the same core principles. Tell us a little bit about Studio B's core principles and your approach and what you're looking to do and the differences you're looking to make and who you're looking to work with.
Yeah, so same people. And whilst we've got the working brain happening, and by the way, we're now focusing on the elderly.
Great.
And getting a good data set, which we've already started. And this
amazing
stuff takes a while, but to understand what the sensory profiles do when we're older. The other thing that we've done is we've assembled a whole bunch of research in designing for stress or trauma and applied it to our own
amazing
way of designing. And there has been research in that area, particularly in Scandinavia, which we found really useful when we're designing spaces that are high stress spaces or trauma spaces. So that's been a passion area for us and an area that we'd love to continue to work in. So specialist family violence spaces in courts. Did you know that until recently, both family members would congregate in the same spaces, which would mean that the one causing the violence would be in the same space as the one who was on the other end of receiving the violence? And therefore, not many, you know, many cases didn't end up in court, because usually the people who were experiencing the violence were too scared to be able to even, you know, take the matter to court. So the whole design of courts in Victoria have changed. And that means that specialist family violence areas created, safe waiting rooms have been created for the affected family member, discreet entry into the spaces. So we were lucky enough to work on those spaces. We were lucky enough to work on a remote witness room. Children, Victoria had four only, and their funding meant that we needed to double that amount. So that means that these children, who are usually children who've been abused and usually sexually abused, are no longer needing to go into any court space. This discrete facility is near the courts, but many people don't know the location. The location's discrete and quite
different experience.
Secretive. It, you know, it doesn't even occur in a court. It's in a spot, not in a court. So many perpetrators don't even know where that would be, so that the witnesses, as we call them, can be in these spaces feeling safe and away. Mm-hmm. They have family rooms. They have communal rooms dotted next to the actual remote witness room, which is the courtroom itself. The courtroom needed to be designed for enabling the best evidence possible for the person. And that meant lots of things like the lighting, the acoustics, the backdrop, and how that person appeared. So it was very technical from that respect. But then also a little bit of joy. You know, we really wanted these spaces not to be institutional or scary, because that's what, you know, these children would otherwise experience in court. So that was a really great sort of project for us. And then we're working with Victoria Legal Aid by way of example, and we started off working with not-for-profits as Artillery, Amnesty International. We did all their offices all over Australia. And going back to Studio BE, we've found that actually this is where our passion lies. And, you know, and when we looked at ourselves carefully, we realized this is it. You know, this is it, you know, social impact stuff, evidence-based design, helping the vulnerable parts of the community. And that is actually what we want to do. We go to sleep at nighttime thinking that we're making a positive impact. The next kind of area of research we'll be doing as well is in, as I talked about, the elderly, but the other one is of interest is designing for unconscious bias, which is particularly interesting. Someone else might lead us to it if they listen to this podcast, but it doesn't matter. It's for the improvement of the society. Yeah, we're working on a beautiful special school in Tasmania at the moment.
Amazing.
Which is for primary and high school and for high needs. And, you know, we're talking about sensory stimulation that can cause fits or convulsions.
Yeah.
Whether it's temperature or light or sound, for example. So the impact of the sensory environment is a whole different level in a space like that that we need to full off. So that's the work we'll stay in doing.
Yeah. Right? And look at me, it's like it's anybody where you're helping people and making a difference and most vulnerable in the community, but thinking about it from that sensory, the entire, you know, if you are going through trauma or anything, you are at that next level. So I think it's I haven't heard many designers talk about it from a sensory design. It might be a throwaway thing, but actually from the core principles of we're actually doing research and looking at this. So I think it's fantastic. It obviously very much aligns to your values in life and what you're doing and caring for people in a very genuine point of view, not just saying it, but genuinely caring and wanting to make a difference to people in doing that. And I think it's to be applauded, and it sounds like you're doing some fantastic things, and I look forward to you. Obviously, you know, there's things aren't just in a Victorian scape, on a national and international scale as well, being able to help people and designing for those. So that's exceptionally exciting. And thank you, Sonia, so much for sharing all of that story. Is there anything that you have to recommend for people in books or podcasts or things that they're interested in this, you know, both as designers or anybody else listening, as people who are interested in how can we design or make places for a better world?
Oh, that's a great question. And I have lots and lots of recommendations. Winnie Dunn's written an amazing book called, Living Sensationally, Understanding Your Senses. Wow. So that's a good resource. The other thing is to look at the, and I'll give you all of that and you can put it on your notes, but the other thing would be to look at the Neurodiversity Hub, which was the brainchild of Andrew Eddy. And within that, there's a section called Enabling Spaces. Within that is a list of resources that people can use, which is a really good tool as well.
I agree with you. When we met, what was it, 2.5 years ago, and, you know, it was an event I was trying, it was 2 years ago, you know, it was the first, it was something that wasn't spoken about. And the great thing is on the neurodiversity theme side, it is something that we are speaking about more, but we're not labelling this under that. It's actually just about understanding the experiences, you know, when you're talking about the courts and everything like that, it's experiences other people are having in a space and what's the circumstances and what's going on and how do we enable, how are people using the space? And I think that's where, Sonia, you've always obviously had that very unique approach of we want to deeply understand what, not just designing for the theory because we've read some article under here. Let's actually do our own research, understand this, and then what can we learn from that research? The world has now, and I think now that these aren't things that you can just ignore. I think they're things that you actually have to really, you know, you think about how much money people spend on a space and refurbing a space. Let's say it's a workspace, but then half of the time people don't thrive in that workspace. You know, it looks lovely, can look very pretty and looks beautiful, but it isn't designed for people to actually to thrive in that. And that sensory part, I think, whether you're neurodiverse or you don't, as you said, 60% of us are sensory. We will feel the difference in what we're doing by what's around us. Designing from a sensory point of view versus just an activity point of view, I think that will continue to evolve. So taking that kind of really reflective versus the, oh, I like the look of this, is a very different way of designing. Yeah.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Sonia, for all of your time. We really appreciate it. And we'll get those show notes off you if there's anybody who's listening, particularly other designers who are interested in learning these things. But, you know, I think you guys, it's not going to be just about learning. You guys are constantly doing research as well. Lovely.
Thank you for all of your positive advocacy in the design world as well.
My pleasure. I mean, I think we both come from a part of wanting to help people and, you know, the best we can possibly be as well. So it's where we have values alignment on that too. Brilliant.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and subscribe. If you're liking this podcast, please rate it because it will actually help other people as well. Now, beyond being able to subscribe, we also have a fantastic newsletter. So if you go to the be-connected.co podcast, you will actually be able to sign up for a newsletter and you will get this on a weekly basis with the latest podcast coming out twice a month and a fantastic newsletter that will give you great insights into the industry, interesting topics of how you can grow professionally and also grow your businesses. We hope you enjoy and thanks so much for listening.